This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. Cybersecurity Malaysia, which is an agency under the Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation, recorded 221 cases of cyber harassment as of April this year. That's almost 2 cases per day, and it considers cyber harassment the third most dangerous threat after fraud and intrusion. One group working to address this is the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, or MCCHR. They, together with a group of human rights activists, have formed a coalition and launched the People Act campaign to find out how best to address this issue. And here to speak about the campaign is MCCHR's CEO, Long Seh Lee, and project manager, Lim Kai. This cybersecurity numbers sounds a bit on the low side. Kai, perhaps I can get you to tell me what is cyber harassment?
So, unfortunately, as of now, there is no actual definition of cyber harassment in Malaysia, but also at an international level. So, while we're doing our research, we are guided by certain, you know, like definitions or interpretations from other countries, and also bodies like the UN has actually provided examples of what they would consist as cyber violence. So, for example, hacking, impersonation, surveillance, harassment, spamming, recruitment, revenge porn, and non-consensual sexting. But UN itself also has not really defined what harassment is. And then we look at jurisdiction like the UK, where they have a Protection Against Harassment Act that defines harassment to include alarming a person or causing the person distress, and it applies to online communication. So I think for the purpose of this discussion, perhaps we can generally just define cyber harassment as any persistent act carried out via the internet or other digital and electronic devices that causes somebody to feel intimidated, distressed, tormented, or humiliated to a point where it creates a hostile environment for them.
Why did you think this is an issue that deserves attention now?
Wow. Well, if you look at the news, there has been increasing reports of people who are being harassed online, on the internet. And so, for example, some examples that we can give is actually a prominent figure who has been expressing views. It could be political views or social views or whatever. And she has been attacked on Facebook, for instance, and people who have actually come out and say that they would have threatened to rape her, or there's also death threat. So this is actually very serious if you look at it, because although some people tend to see that it is online, it may not manifest physically, but it is still a form of violence. And particularly the research that we've done, it affects women more disproportionately than men. So that's why we think that it is a serious issue that needs to be tackled.
So what happens when a threat like that is made online? Is there anything that the person at the receiving end can do?
Usually, because unfortunately there's still no law regulating cyber harassment in Malaysia. So, but there are bodies like MCMC who actually sort of enforce what's in the Communications and Multimedia Act. And that is supposed to be regulating, you know, communications that's considered obscene, malicious, indecent, etc., etc. And they can actually make report to the MCMC or actually the police, who will then look at it and see whether the prosecution can be done. So apart from that, what we normally do is to actually encourage people to have prevention. So in terms of, you know, although you have freedom to on the internet, but you need to also look at security as well, like passwords and things like that. And so unfortunately, so far, that is kind of what people can do.
Sally, usually when a case like this happens, the counter argument to that is freedom of expression, and they have the freedom to insult. So where is the line between the freedom for someone to say something that is not so positive, and when does it become harassment?
I think let me start by saying that there is no such right as freedom to insult. And why I want to clarify this is I do not want to conflate insulting comments with being indifferent to consequences of our unrestrained comments and postings online. So we are free to make insulting comments, such as calling people names. It is rude. You may get into trouble, i.e. people will insult you back, but it is not illegal and it's not a criminal offence to post insulting comments online. There is no legal definition of what is insulting, and the Communications and Multimedia Act 1998, which is one of the main laws dealing with harassment, does not contain the word insult when it spells out the offences in Section 2331 and 211 of the Act. Now, if you look at the ordinary dictionary meaning, to insult means to speak to or treat with disrespect or scornful abuse. And to illustrate the difference between insulting comments and online harassment, I think it would be best if I refer to laws in other countries where the offence of harassment, whether online or offline, is more clearly defined. So if you look at Section 3 of the Singapore Protection from Harassment Act, it lists out three elements that must be established to prove harassment. Now, the first is the intent to cause harassment, alarm or distress to another person. The second element, the person must use any threatening, abusive or insulting words or behaviour. And thirdly, the words or behaviour must cause the other person or any other person harassment, alarm or distress. Now, what you see is that the word insulting words and behaviour is just one of the elements to prove the offence of harassment. So on its own, insulting comments, it's not an offence itself.
Does this include hate speech as well?
Hate speech is not defined in the Harassment Act of Singapore. And also actually in laws in Malaysia, there's actually no explicit reference to hate speech in our laws. Even when you look at laws in other countries and international human rights conventions, you won't find a universally accepted definition of what is hate speech. What you have is specific prohibitions, such as prohibition against incitement of discrimination, prohibition of any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, the prohibition against inciting others to commit genocide, and also the prohibition against inciting war or terrorism. Now, these laws may be used to address hate speech, but I think I'd like to emphasize here that there must be a distinction between genuine and serious incitement to extremism and the right of individuals to express their views freely and to offend, shock, or disturb others.
What happens if that offensive comment or statement results in someone taking their own life? Can they be held accountable?
I think recently in another jurisdiction, I do not remember which country, I think the person who incited someone to commit suicide was found guilty. And this is actually quite interesting because in Ireland, they recently passed a law. It's called the Harmful and Malicious Electronic Communications Act 2015. And it makes it an offence for someone to incite or encourage another to commit suicide or to harm themselves. Yeah. So in certain countries, specifically, they spell out, you know, if you incite someone to commit suicide, it's an offence.
Right. Yeah, that was the case of Michelle Carter, if I'm not mistaken, in the US. And earlier in the year in Malaysia as well, there was the first reported case of a person committing suicide as a result of cyberbullying. How would you make the person accountable because of the anonymous nature of internet usage?
I think there are ways where the MCMC can actually trace your IP address. Whilst you may be anonymous online, I think it's possible to trace you. I understand there's also VPN networks out there, but it just takes time. And MCMC has been summoned to court to actually provide the IP address. So to a certain extent, it you may be anonymous, but that it can be traceable. And I think if you harass someone to the extent that someone commits suicide, I think then it's met the threshold of seriousness to warrant a trace of your IP address.
Proving the causation would be a challenge.
I think it would be challenging, particularly in Malaysia, where there is no specific laws dealing with inciting someone to commit suicide. And I say this because the more specific the law, the more easier, or at least we know what elements we need to prove the offence. And so in Ireland, the law is pretty new, so it's not quite been tested yet. But the American case is actually one of the newer cases where this lady was found guilty. I think that a lot of commentaries came up by the legal scholars on how she was found guilty, rightly or wrongly, within the US law.
I'm speaking today to Long Sally and Lim Kai from the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, or MCCHR. We'll talk more about the People Act campaign that they are organising after this short break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. My name is Chua Ng Tik. On the show today, Long Sally, CEO of the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and Lim Kai, who is the project manager at MCCHR. We're here to talk about the People Act campaign. It's a campaign to raise awareness about cyber harassment, and as well as some of the remedy or reforms that might be needed in this country to address this issue. Who can tell me about what the campaign entails, and when has it started, and what's the latest?
So MCCHR has been running a civic education program since its inception in 2011. So it's called Undi Malaysia, and its objective is really to provide knowledge and tools to young Malaysians to participate and play an active role in our democratic process. So it's not just about voting once in every 5 years, but also what it means to actually work with multiple stakeholders to solve issues that affect them. And by doing so, to have a voice and space in our decision-making process, basically. So this is what we actually term as participatory democracy. So in 2013, Undi Malaysia launched a project called Scholar Activism. And this is to further enhance its civic education program by providing a longer term of training workshops on various aspects of activism for youth. And this resulted in two campaigns. So last 2 years, we decided that we want to actually increase our commitment to create awareness on what it means participatory democracy is. So we invited various civil society organizations to come together and participate in a consultation process to determine what issues exactly that they all want to advocate for. And unanimously, they said that cyber harassment is the issue because it affects everybody, women, children, men, human rights defenders, etc., etc. So that's where People Act was actually conceived. So People Act's mission is to make the cyber environment a safer, more respectful and empowering space for Malaysians through strategic legislative advocacy and public awareness campaign. So what this really entails is we have a training program to equip the member as the first point so that we know how to actually roll out a strategic advocacy campaign. And once this is done, we actually follow up with we are giving ourselves sort of like 2 years. It's a 2-year campaign on creating public awareness on cyber harassment. That's one component. The other component is actually to carry out survey documenting incidents of cyber harassment in Malaysia so that we can understand all these issues that's affecting Malaysia and not just looking at overseas cases. Conducting a legal research to address legal gaps within our own law in addressing the issue. And from this, we will actually consult multi-stakeholders on coming up with legislative solutions to cyber harassment. And this is intended to produce an effective legislative recommendations to lawmakers and relevant enforcement agencies on how to tackle the issue. Finally, we would like to actually produce a survival kit to support survivors of cyber harassment. So at this stage in time, we've actually done the legal research, the survey, documentation of the incidents of cyber harassment, and we are actually getting the public to provide us feedback and their opinion on what they think are the maybe legislative reform that needs to be done to address cyber harassment.
Could you run through some of the findings from that survey?
So from the survey, we managed to actually get 522 respondents, and they're all over Malaysia, across Malaysia. So the finding is quite interesting in the sense that a little bit over 50% of the respondents actually said that they have experienced some form of online harassment before. And survey also actually found that it does affect women disproportionately in terms of sexual harassment, online sexual harassment, but also issues like revenge porn. So this conclusively tells us that the issue of online harassment does affect women more than men. Another finding that we find is that majority of the respondents actually use tools like WhatsApp the most, Facebook secondly, and then email as forms of online communications. And it also shows that the longer they spend on the internet, they are more exposed to online harassment. It also shows that men, in fact, experience online hateful comments, online shaming, and online spying more than women. And 41% of the respondents actually claim that they have felt fearful, threatened, or uneasy because of the comments they have received online. So these are some of the findings that we have.
You mentioned a few acts of harassment, but I want to just go back to last year when the federal court produced this judgment on what many would say is a landmark judgment on sexual harassment. Does it cover harassment that takes place online as well?
Okay, for this landmark judgment case, the federal court actually undertook judicial activism where they actually now say that sexual harassment should be included in the tort of harassment, which is a really good moving forward. So what has happened was the federal court actually referred to the Employment Act when they interpret what is sexual harassment. And they actually said that sexual harassment is, you know, unwelcome conduct taking in the form of verbal and even physical comments that include sexual innuendos, suggestive comments, obscenity or insulting sounds, displaying offensive pictures, making obscene gestures, etc. So it doesn't actually say that online, it includes online comments. However, the judges actually said that sexual harassment is actually a very serious misconduct and in whatever form it takes. So the key word used here is whatever form, and they went on to say that in whatever form it comes, it actually lowers the dignity and respect of the person who is being harassed. So with this, it would appear that the tort of harassment does encompass online sexual harassment because of the word whatever forms it takes.
You mentioned some laws overseas as well as the MCMC on how they govern obscene materials. What would be considered obscene?
So in Malaysia, the laws on obscenity are being regulated by the Penal Code and the Communications and Multimedia Act. So the Penal Code actually say that it is an offence to distribute, to publish and to actually possess any obscene content. But it doesn't actually go on to actually define what obscenity is. So this become a bit of a problem. And it's the same with the Communications and Multimedia Act as well, where it says that it's an offence to actually, you know, make any obscene comments, but it doesn't go on to define what obscenity is. But the Malaysian courts in previous cases have actually interpreted what they think obscenity is. And maybe here I can actually share some of the interpretation that they have come up with. And one of them is actually taking into account of the element of tendency. So it says that obscenity is when there's a tendency to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to such immoral influences. And this can actually include things like sexual acts which are being filmed, produced, sold and distributed. So there was a case where you have a flight attendant who actually filmed sexual activities between him and other flight attendants, I think including his wife as well, and it was captured in a VCD. So the court actually said that this is considered as obscene. Then you have another case where the court has interpreted it in a more narrow manner, where there is no test of a, for instance, a reasonable person's test. And it actually said that...
Sorry, can I just stop you there? What does that mean?
Okay, so... So what this means is it shouldn't... So the definition of obscenity should not be determined by someone who could have a very low threshold of what obscenity means. It must be based on what any reasonable person And I would actually add on that from the UK model that we have learned is that it must not just be a reasonable person, but also a person living in a just, multiracial society. And to us, that's very important because then it doesn't fall back on relying on, let's say, a judge or an authority who has a very low standard of what obscenity means.
Is that standard specific to the Malaysian context or is it a universal standard?
At the moment, it's the UK standard.
Okay.
So the other interpretation that one case has produced is actually to define obscene as to mean offensively or repulsively indecent, especially by offending accepted sexual morality. So this one, the judge didn't actually use the standard of a reasonable person. So it's like as long as it's seen as offensive and repulsively indecent, then it is considered as obscene. But there is a content code which has been developed by the Communications and Multimedia Content Forum. This is a society actually that's formed to facilitate communications and multimedia industry to self-regulate themselves online. And this content code actually provide a much more detailed definition of what obscenity is. So it actually went on to define it as content that has the tendency to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to such communications, but also it gives very clear example of what obscenity, obscene content is. So, for example, it says that any portrayal of sexual activity that a reasonable adult would consider as explicit and pornographic, such as sexual crimes like rape, attempted rape, bestiality, child pornography, sexual degradation of men, women or children, and sexual violence are actually prohibited and should be considered as obscene. So this is very clearly defined. But unfortunately, this content code is not legally binding. It's only to help C&M industry to self-regulate themselves.
And would you advocate that being turned into law?
Well, for us, I think our position is that yes, but only if the content and publication falls within the interpretation of obscenity that's prescribed by a law which are based on a test of the reasonable person test in an open and just multiracial society as the UK has prescribed. So it shouldn't be left undefined, very narrow, and it should not be left to only a judge to define it according to the standard that he or she perceived to be obscene. So it needs to have a reasonable person's test.
Okay. So if we have a concrete definition of what obscenity is, would you advocate for its censorship?
Well, if you look at what the content code has said about, you know, like sexual violence, I would say that if there are content that depicts sexual violence of rape, bestiality, child pornography, I think it should be subjected to censorship.
You spoke a little bit about how at the moment, because of a lack of laws that specifically mention cyber harassment, so there are a few instances where victims or sufferers of revenge porn, for example, would not have a place to seek justice. So if you find yourself in the unfortunate circumstances of being a victim of revenge porn or online stalking, for example, what are we to do?
Okay, so if for victims of revenge porn, I think what they can do is actually file a police report immediately. Seek advice and support from NGOs or lawyers. But also I found out that you can actually ask Google to take it down. And Google has in fact expressed their commitment to honour requests to remove revenge porn from their search engine. So this is something which I've learned recently, that if you find yourself to be a victim of revenge porn and you have images of yourself being uploaded on the website, you can actually tell Google to actually remove it from the search engine, and they are committed to honouring it. So that's second. And third one, not to delete the original photo to prove ownership of that photo. So this goes back to, I think, the questions of who owns the image of a person who, you know, in a compromising state. So generally, if the photo is a selfie, which apparently, based on an American research, 80% of intimate pictures of someone who has been sent to, you know, like an ex-boyfriend or whatever, are actually in fact selfies. So copyright belongs to the person who actually take the photo. So it would belong to the person in that image itself. But in my opinion, the question of ownership shouldn't even be the point, because you have countries, again, I'm citing other examples from other countries. The UK and Australia actually have introduced new criminal offence of actually revenge porn. So anybody who disclose private sexual photographs and films or intimate image without the consent of an individual who appears in those images with the intent to cause the individual distress, or if the image is contrary to community standards of acceptable conduct, then it's actually a crime. So it wouldn't matter about, you know, copyright or who owns the photos.
In line with that, because so much of our information is available on social media and online, and most of it is posted by ourselves, do we have any claim to privacy? Or in other words, do we have a right to privacy?
In the case of Sivarasa Rasia, the federal court, when they interpreted the ambit of Article 5.1 of the Constitution, which guarantees the right to personal liberty, actually stated that the right to personal liberty includes the right to privacy. So you have a court that recognises the right to privacy. But whether we have an actionable thought of invasion of privacy, I think the law in this area is quite unsettled. So it would appear that the courts are still trying to figure out whether they want to recognise this tort of invasion of privacy. So you have a couple of cases like Maslinda Isha Lee Yupo actually recognises the tort of invasion of privacy. And you have a number of cases that recognise this right to privacy, but only in matters of private morality and modesty. And then there are a couple of cases where the courts actually did not want to recognise the tort of invasion of privacy. So although a victim or survivor of cyber harassment could arguably avail themselves to this tort, I think it must be acknowledged that this could be a challenging task.
Would you be able to give some background to those cases, as in what were the invasions of privacy?
Sure. So Maslinda Isha was the case, if you remember. There was the RELA officers who had rounded up some women for working as guest relation officers. And they were all put in a truck. And one of them wanted to, because it was rather a long time, and one of the women wanted to relieve herself. And she asked the RELA officers, and the RELA officers said, just relieve yourself in the truck. So as the other women were trying to cover her while she was relieving herself, one of the RELA officers actually took a photo of her while she was relieving herself. So in that case, the court actually said that the privacy of Maslinda Isha was violated and recognised the thought of invasion of privacy. And the other cases which they limit to private morality and modesty is when a doctor was performing a surgery and took a photo of a part of a person, a woman that he was performing the operation on without her consent. Now, this led to a change in the medical profession where they actually now ask patients to sign a consent form. Even though the doctor said that, you know, I took the photo for my records, it was not to shame you or anything, it was part of his profession. But the court recognised that doctors actually now must ask consent from patients before they photograph them while on the operating theatre.
In the online world, though, would it be wrong for us to release a personal text message without the other person's consent?
Well, if the text message or the emails is in respect of a commercial transaction, then I say, and it falls, and also it falls within the definition of personal data under the Personal Data Protection Act 2010, then you can claim a breach of personal data. But
so this is like personal information, bank account details, things like that. Okay.
Yes, but only the PDPA only applies in commercial transactions. So it must relate to any transaction of a commercial nature, which includes matters relating to supply or exchange of goods and services, etc. Now, outside commercial transactions, I think it would be a good case to test the boundaries of the right to privacy. Like, you have the right to privacy already recognized in the Sivarasa case. And I think that could be used to argue that if you release my text message or my emails without my consent, that could be a breach of confidence, I think. But we have not had any cases yet.
So how can the public be a part of this campaign if they'd like to give their feedback?
So we have a website which is www.mcchr.org/SLA. So on that page, you actually have the issues paper that we've actually done, and we would like you to comment on the issue paper by submitting. There's an email address that you can submit your comments to, and the deadline is, I think, 24th of October 2017. So there's still some time, and we really want the public to participate. And also mainly because we see this as a process where we want to impart awareness to the public that in order to have any reform, you need to actually participate and not let the person that you vote into power to make all the decisions for you. And therefore, stop, you know, like, always complaining that, look, things are being decided for me and I have no say in it. My fate is left to, you know, my Wakil Rakyat or MP. So do participate by giving us what you think about this, because it does affect every Malaysian. The other thing would be, we really strongly encourage the public to also create awareness on what cyber harassment is among themselves. And we are doing projects where we collaborate with people like Freedom Film Network, who has done, you know, like, documentaries on cyber harassment or whatever that has a education element, and we can actually do it together, have a screening, and then have a discussion on cyber harassment. That's one thing. We also strongly encourage people to start to think about internet security. So prevention is always better, you know, in terms of this. So you can actually request for a group digital security training workshop, and we are actually partnering with organizations like Empower as well, who is actually doing the training. And there are other staff, like, participate in our online survey, which is still ongoing. This can be obtained in our MCCHR website, the one that I've mentioned before. Help us to document incidents of online harassment by sending us screenshots of harassment if you are being harassed. And we have we have a privacy policy that we abide by, so we will honour your anonymity in that sense. Join our campaign by liking our Undi Malaysia Facebook page so that you can actually share articles. We post up articles on cyber harassment on a daily basis. So share that. And also, you can be a volunteer for People Act. We actually welcome anybody who's interested in the issue and would like to join us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kai. Thank you, Sally.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.